On 104.5 FM, this is WRFU LP Urbana. It's 6 p.m. on Thursday, and time for A Critical Ear, presented by Andrew O'Boyle and Robert Naiman. Good evening and welcome to another edition of A Critical Ear. I'm Andrew O'Boyle. With me, as usual, is Bob Naiman in Urbana. Good afternoon, Bob.
Good afternoon, Andrew.
And, Bob, you're just recently back from Cairo, where you were taking part in the Gaza Freedom March. Perhaps first, some of our listeners will be familiar with news reports and the like from the march, but for those who are not, what was the Gaza Freedom March?
The Gaza Freedom March was an international effort involving about 1,400 people from some 43 countries, including the United States. The largest group was a group of some 700 Americans who traveled to Egypt with the intention of traveling to Gaza on the anniversary, the one-year anniversary of the Israeli invasion of Gaza a year ago, with the intention the chief intention of protesting and drawing attention to the Israeli blockade on Gaza, which is supported by Egypt and the United States. The Gaza Freedom March intended to bring in humanitarian aid, knowing, of course, that the amount that they could actually bring in would be small relative to the need, but that it would be something, and also it would be symbolic and political in terms of, you know, expressing concern about civilians in Gaza, as well as drawing attention to the blockade.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bob, you work with Just Foreign Policy. How did you see this issue, this event, corresponding to your work in that organization? What were the linkages you saw there?
Well, we have written and asked our members to take action on this issue in the past, working with other organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace and other groups that work on this issue, asking people to write to Congress in support of congressional letters against the blockade, including the last month or so. And of course, we opposed the Israeli invasion a year ago and the support of that invasion by the Bush administration, and called for ceasefire and supported congressional efforts to try to bring about a ceasefire to stop that violence, to stop that assault. So this is an issue that we've been working on for some time. This is a somewhat different way of working on it, but it seemed like a good opportunity to try and help draw attention to the blockade because of the timing, the one-year anniversary. Also, as a kind of practical matter, because the trip was happening, you know, more or less over the Christmas break, it seemed like a good time to go. You know, much of everything else is shutting down. Congress is out of session. People are on vacation. As you know, I do ordinarily, and on a usual weekday, I do a news summary of news related to U.S. foreign policy, just foreign policy news. I put that on suspension shortly before Christmas on the 23rd. You know, the idea that anyway, people are traveling, so not paying as much attention to their email. So it was an opportunity to do something a little bit different, to try and call attention to these issues, increase awareness in the United States and around the world. But of course, our particular focus is on the United States. And I think we had some success in that regard, in terms of there was sort of direct reporting. I was blogging on Huffington Post and Common Dreams, Daily Kos, and of course, you know, many others of the 1400 were doing similar things, Huffington Post and elsewhere, so getting out the news directly. But also got some even certainly alternative press. Democracy Now! Covered the march, but even mainstream press. There was a Christian Science Monitor article. There were two articles in the New York Times. I heard that there was a report on CNN and one on CBS. So the march did get some attention, even in the U.S. press. It was all over Arab media. Al Jazeera reported it was in the front page of Egyptian newspapers. So big news in the region, and it not only called attention to the blockade in general, but specifically to the role of the Egyptian government. Obviously, this is a policy initiated by the Israeli government, but one that could not be implemented without the cooperation of the Egyptian government, because Gaza has two land borders. You know, it has a land border with Israel and a land border with Egypt. There's a border crossing between Gaza and Egypt at Rafah, in the southern end of the Gaza Strip, and if the Egyptian government weren't, for the most part, keeping that closed, there would be no effective Israeli blockade on Gaza. So it's really, people call it, referred to it as an Israeli blockade, and it is, but it's really an Israeli-Egyptian-American blockade, because without the cooperation of these three countries, really, there could be no blockade on Gaza.
Mm-hmm. And that last point that you made was something that I'd wanted to have you elaborate on, because as you note, many people, of those people who are aware of the blockade of Gaza, many may either assume that it is purely an Israeli blockade, or indeed may not be familiar with the fact that there is an Egyptian border with Gaza.
Yes, that's true. Everything that you said is true. First of all, many people aren't aware at all. Secondly, to the extent that people are aware, they may not be aware of the role of the Egyptian government. I think that may have changed to some degree over the course of the past few weeks as a result of, you know, these events. It was reported even in the U.S. press that, to some degree, that Egypt blocked us or blocked most of us from going to Gaza, that the Egyptian police repressed our protests in Egypt, in particular on Thursday, the day that we were to have been participating in the Gaza Freedom March in Gaza. We were protesting in Cairo. Some of us were protesting. Actually, some of us were blocked from leaving our hotels. I was blocked from leaving the Lotus Hotel where we were staying. So a small group of us just protested where we were. I was able to slip out later through a back entrance and join the main group. But the main group was dragged from the street, and a couple people were badly injured by the Egyptian police. So, you know, that was reported a little bit in the U.S., more widely in the Arab world. So all these events contributed to highlighting the role of the Egyptian government in the blockade. That wasn't the intention that wasn't the original intention of the marchers. You know, the original intent was that Egypt was just a transit point. But the Egyptian government, through its actions, chose to make its policies an issue, and I think that more people now see it as an Israeli-Egyptian blockade than saw it that way a month ago.
A really basic question, and I suppose I'm to a certain extent. I don't want to feign, you know, ignorance or stupidity on this one. Why protest a blockade? What is the negative impact of the blockade that caused, that was the reason for wanting to protest it and feeling that this was, a particularly egregious thing that needed to be combated?
Well, first of all, from a humanitarian point of view, there's tremendous civilian suffering in Gaza as a result of the blockade. I mean, as has been reported a little bit in the mainstream press, Gaza has never been allowed to rebuild since the Israeli invasion. There was tremendous destruction during the Israeli invasion. Many houses were destroyed. Many buildings were destroyed. A lot of Gaza's infrastructure was destroyed. But Gaza hasn't been allowed to rebuild because they haven't been able to import materials to rebuild. They haven't been able to import concrete, for example. That's been blocked. So there's a humanitarian crisis there. That's number one. That, even if nothing else were true, that would be enough to justify action. Obviously, calling attention to the humanitarian crisis and demanding action to address the crisis. But moreover, the blockade is a grave violation of international law. It's collective punishment directed at Gaza's civilian population. The blockade was initiated originally when Hamas won the 2006 Palestinian legislative elections and was tightened after Hamas took formal control of Gaza in 2007. And it's more or less openly stated. I mean, sometimes the blockade is justified by the Israeli government on security grounds. We have to impose this blockade to prevent Hamas from importing weapons. But it's more or less acknowledged that the goal of the blockade is to punish the civilian population of Gaza for having voted for Hamas in the 2006 Palestinian elections, you know, sort of teach the people a lesson not to support Hamas anymore. And this is, of course, a grave violation of international law. It's not allowed in international law to punish the civilian population. I mean, it's a form of terrorism. If you look at the, you know, textbook definition of terrorism, it's use of violence against a civilian population in order to achieve a political goal. That's what the blockade is. Collective punishment is barred under international law. So the Israeli government is in violation of international law, the Egyptian government is in violation of international law, and the U.S. government is in violation of international law by participating in this blockade. Those are the reasons that there's something there worth protesting. Obviously, it's something that every able-bodied, educated citizen of the world would have a reason to protest. But particularly as Americans, given that the role of our government in implementing this policy, it's a particular reason for us to protest. And to try, it may seem like a somewhat extravagant way of doing so, you know, traveling there. But that's, of course, a time-honored tactic of people protesting blockades, is to, you know, try to break them, or, you know, try to bring in aid in opposition to, or even in violation of, a blockade. In December 1996, I participated in the Fourth Voices in the Wilderness delegation to Iraq, bringing in medical aid to Iraq in violation of the U.S.-UN embargo. And of course, you know, similarly in that case, the point was both to bring in real aid, which was much needed, but also to draw attention to the blockade. You know, I think we had a belief that as Americans we would have a unique opportunity to try and bring the attention of U.S. media and bring the attention of people in the U.S. To these issues. There's already some concern about these issues in Congress. There have been a number of congressional letters that, if you add them all up, dozens of members of Congress have signed. There are several circulating even now. And I think our hope was, and remains, that these events of the last few weeks will contribute to these efforts.
You mentioned the success of bringing some media attention and presumably as a result of media attention, more public awareness to these issues. That was something following the updates of yourself and others early on in the story of this march last week, where there wasn't initially a lot. In fact, there was very little mainstream news coverage of this event within the United States. That's something that changed as the week went on. What are your thoughts or reflections on how that progressed?
I was delighted by the change. At the beginning, as you say, there was a kind of a blackout.
I should note there, it's, you know, if nowhere is covering it, it might be seen, well, maybe it wasn't newsworthy. You were contrasting that with foreign news media and the fact that there were reports in the British press, in the European press, the French media, I believe, covered quite a bit of stories around this generally, and of course also Al Jazeera. So there was coverage outside of the United States of this.
That's right, and you know, you had the funny situation where European and Arab media were covering a protest by Americans, largely, I mean, of course, it was an international group, but the largest group, half of the 1,400 people were Americans, people who had traveled, you know, all the way from the United States to Egypt. And, you know, in terms of the, you know, like the cost of traveling and the labor involved in going, it was, you know, it's a bigger distance, more money. So you would think from a human interest point of view that some U.S. media would be interested, right? And 700 Americans are spending their Christmas break in Egypt trying to go to Gaza. Maybe there's a story there. And then the Egyptian government, which is you know, very closely allied to the United States, sits on top of these protesters and will let them go to Gaza, represses their protest in Egypt. Again, you would think that that's a story. The European press thought it was a story, and the Arab press thought it was a story. But at first, the U.S. press didn't think it was a story. Just Foreign Policy actually did an alert asking people to write the New York Times and the Washington Post and demand that they cover the march and cover these events, noting the disparity between the American press and the European and Arab press. Subsequently, there was a shift. As I mentioned, there was an article in the Christian Science Monitor. There were two articles in the New York Times. That's just referring to press that was, you know, directly talking about the march. There were also a couple articles in the New York Times about the situation in Gaza, which hadn't appeared before. Now, you know, would those have appeared anyway? Who knows? But I think that it helped draw attention, help not only, you know, get these articles about the protests, but also get more articles generally about the situation in Gaza.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned to kind of move the story of the march along somewhat for our listeners. You mentioned earlier the Egyptians refused initially to allow any of the marchers through to Gaza. They modified their situation slightly as the week progressed.
Yeah, there was, of course, sustained effort to try to get the Egyptian government to change its position. People wrote and called Egyptian embassies around the world, and there were all sorts of public and private appeals, including some folks from Code Pink, Medea Benjamin, and Jody Evans, actually had a little bit of a relationship with Suzanne Mubarak, the First Lady of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak's wife, and managed to get a meeting with her, asked her to intervene. As a result of that discussion, the Egyptian government agreed to let 100 of the 1,400 in to go into Gaza. And in the event, 86 or 87 of the 1,400 wound up being allowed, being able to go into Gaza from Egypt. A smaller number, I'm not sure exactly how many, when it was clear that they wouldn't be able to cross the Gaza-Egypt border, actually went from Egypt to Israel and joined the protest that was planned for the Israeli side of the border, the Israelis protesting against the blockade. So in the event, there were actually protests on that Thursday in Gaza, Israel, and Egypt against the blockade, all of which involved internationals that had come for the Gaza Freedom March. Mm-hmm.
Now, you also mentioned earlier some of the attacks by the Egyptian police on the marchers when they were in Cairo protesting and looking to be allowed across the border. What sort of repression? What sort of attacks were involved in that?
Well, the main thing was the harshest example that I was directly aware of was on the Thursday when protesters were dragged from the street by Egyptian police. Several people reported that they were thrown, kicked, punched. It was reported that one woman had broken ribs, had to go to the hospital. But also people reported on that on Tuesday, when they a number of Americans tried to go to the U.S. Embassy to appeal to the U.S. Embassy to intervene and were initially blocked from even approaching their own embassy in Cairo. And several people reported being hit, manhandled by the Egyptian police. So that's pretty striking, given that, you know, particularly in the case of people, as the reporter, just trying to reach the U.S. Embassy. I mean, they weren't trying to do anything other than go to the U.S. Embassy. And there was a belief among several of the protesters that this was at least in part the result of U.S. government action, that the U.S. Embassy had asked the Egyptian police to keep the Americans away from their embassy.
Has there been any response from the State Department or other U.S. government sources to those reports of, or you know, more than reports? You are directly aware of this, of people not being able to attend their own government's embassy.
I'm not aware of any State Department. I didn't see any State Department response on that.
Okay. Now the Gaza Freedom March of which you were part was one of two major international events to mark the anniversary of the invasion. The other was the Viva Palestina convoy. Could you explain what was that convoy? Had it any? Was it wholly separate? Was there any interaction or relationship between that and the march?
Yeah, Viva Palestina is also an international organization, but initiated. It's British initiated, as opposed to the Gaza Freedom March, largely American initiated. The most prominent personality associated with the Viva Palestina convoy is the British parliamentarian George Galloway of the Respect Party, former Labour Party member, broke with the Labour Party over its support of the U.S. war policies. Viva Palestina has conducted a couple convoys to Gaza, and these are major enterprises because they go by ground. This one started out in Britain months ago, snaked through several countries, including Turkey and Jordan, picking up aid along the way. The Viva Palestina convoy was officially supported by the Turkish government, an arm, a humanitarian arm of the Turkish government. Supplied trucks for the convoy, and the Turkish authorities actually attempted to intervene diplomatically with the Egyptian government when the Viva Palestina convoy was blocked, as it was during the time that we were there. They had reached the Jordanian port of Aqaba on the Red Sea, which is right next to Egypt, and the convoy attempted to cross there, and the Egyptian government wouldn't let them through. Turkey tried to mediate and intervene diplomatically to allow the convoy to go in. The Egyptians refused and insisted that the convoy turn back and take a long way around, go back through Jordan, go through Syria, come by boat to Al-Arish on the other side, on the Mediterranean side. Al-Arish is sort of the largest Egyptian city in the Sinai, close to the Rafah, the Palestinian city of Rafah in Gaza. So the Viva Palestina convoy had similar travails to the Gaza Freedom March. the two organizations are not linked in any formal way. But as things progressed, you could see in the media, and there was communication between the two groups, and in their media, they were calling attention to each other and the fact that they're facing similar problems from the Egyptian authorities.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I should mention that there was a group of there is an American component of Viva Palestina. There were a group of Americans on the convoy. There's a U.S. organization that's part of the International Viva Palestina organization.
Mm-hmm. The last I'd seen, I don't know whether you have any updates on this, but was that the Egyptians, you know, having come to some arrangement to allow passage via a longer route through Egypt, had then required or had said that some portion, I think 25% of the aid or the convoy should enter Gaza through Israel. Did you have you seen that? And what was the it seemed to be a lot of you know, we'll let you, as long as it's not the entire convoy, we'll let part of it, or we'll let this. What was your sense of what was happening there?
Well, it was quite a mess at the end. You know, the understanding of the people in the convoy was that they had negotiated a deal. And that was certainly, I mean, if you read the press coverage, that's what it appeared to be at the time. You know, this unpleasant compromise where when they were turned back at Aqaba through the Turkish mediation, you know, they agreed that they would go back through Jordan, back through Syria, get on these boats, which of course, you know, added time, logistics, and expense. And they had to do an additional fundraising in order to pay for this securitous Rube Goldberg scheme of, you know, driving back around and putting everything on boats, flying people, you know, they couldn't put all the people on these cargo ships, right? So they got to get the trucks on the boats, but they couldn't put all the people on the boats. They flew the people to Egypt, so they did emergency fundraising back in Britain and in the Arab world, and Turkey and so on. They finally got all their people and stuff to Arish, and then the Egyptian government reneged and wouldn't let them all through. As you said, insisted that 25% of the convoy go through Israel, you know, which for no apparent reason, and people on the convoy refused, saying that, you know, the past experience is that stuff that goes through Israel doesn't go through. So that would just be like throwing away 25% of the convoy. So there were protests then in Arish, protests by the people in the Viva Palestina convoy, and there were clashes with the Egyptian police. Then then there was a protest in Gaza. Hamas organized a protest in Gaza at the border, protesting the fact that the Viva Palestina convoy wasn't being allowed through, and that led to clashes between Palestinians that were protesting on the Palestinian side of the border and the Egyptian police. And in that confrontation, according to news reports, one Egyptian policeman was killed. It's not clear how, several Palestinians were wounded by live Egyptian fire. That, of course, that confrontation, I think, caused very bad publicity for the Egyptian government, and they subsequently relented and allowed the convoy through, and it did, in fact, finally reach Gaza.
Mm-hmm. And I know myself, I've seen reports that you mentioned in the protests in El Arish yesterday that there were a number of Irish civilians who were part of the convoy who were reportedly injured in that, up to five Irish civilians were reportedly injured, as they during those protests.
I didn't see that. I know that there were five folks from Londonderry that were on the convoy, but I didn't see any report about them being injured in the protests.
Okay, yeah, I'd say my reports on that somewhat third hand, though there were a number of Irish politicians who've issued statements on the issue in recent days and drew attention to the fact that they'd seen reports to that effect. We're talking to you as you're back in Urbana just after traveling back. Also a long winding journey back from Cairo for you. You went to some expense. There was some expense involved in actually traveling there. How do you feel out the far side, having made the journey, and now returned? You didn't get to enter Gaza as you had hoped on planning your trip on leaving, but as you mentioned, there has been an amount of media coverage and so on. How do you feel about having undertaken this this trip, this effort?
As you said, it did not turn out as planned, and yet there's no question in my mind that it was tremendously worthwhile in terms of the attention that it drew to the issue. And I mean, and in fact, just the attention that it drew to the issue in Egypt alone, I think, would have justified the enterprise. As I said, it was front page news in the Egyptian press. Everybody, people would stop you on the street, recognizing that you're American, and they would know that's why we were there, which is pretty striking because, Americans go to Cairo for other reasons than trying to enter Gaza. So there was the high level of awareness about it in Egypt, and it drew attention to the blockade, drew attention to the role of the Egyptian government, and added some pressure there. Anything, and of course, it has to be noted that, as the Christian Science Monitor said in its report, Egypt is a police state. There's no there's no freedom of assembly in Egypt. There's no freedom of the press in Egypt. I mean, it's not zero. People have protests, but they're regularly constrained and repressed. And there's a media that reports on things, but it's also constrained. So I think, in addition to shining a light on the situation in Gaza and the role of the Egyptian government, we also opened up a little space temporarily in Egypt. You could see this in places that we would gather. Egyptians would gather around. Some, sympathetic Egyptians would gather around, and you could also see that a top priority of the Egyptian police was separating us from Egyptians. That was the top thing that they were doing. Even on, for example, on New Year's Eve, when we had sort of a non-protest gathering in a square in Cairo, partly because there was no private place where we could meet, so we met in a public square, and the Egyptian police didn't molest us, didn't prevent us from meeting, but they prevented us from interacting with the Egyptians. They formed a wall around us, and when Egyptians tried to mingle with us, the Egyptian police shooed them away. And I think, it was sort of obvious the dynamic was that the sympathetic Egyptians wanted to connect with us and also saw that there was this little bubble where some activity was being permitted that isn't normally permitted, and they wanted to get in on it. And of course, the Egyptian state wasn't going to have any of that. Their attitude was, okay, we have this temporary cancer that we have to tolerate to some degree, or we're going to isolate it until it goes away. But still, I think that it had a salutary effect, and there was a number of elements of cooperation began to develop while we're there. Some of the protests at the internationals. One of the protests took place at the Egyptian Journalists Association, which is kind of standard place that where Egyptians are in fact allowed to protest. Some of the internationals signed on to a lawsuit that some Egyptian lawyers have brought against the government, seeking to overturn the Egyptian government's support of the blockade. So I think those things were all positive, and some of those relationships I think are going to continue, and some there's going to be more international involvement in some of those in support of some of those Egyptian efforts.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I found striking when you talk about the Egyptian authorities feeling this was, an undesirable thing, but something they had to tolerate to some extent, that they couldn't just, squash and get rid of. Am I right in my understanding that none of the marchers were arrested during the demonstrations?
That's absolutely correct, and it seemed to be quite clearly a deliberate policy by the Egyptian authorities to avoid arresting any internationals.
Okay, so there was some suppression. You mentioned there was some violence during
kicking, hitting, and dragging, but no arresting.
Okay, and that's kind of there's a kind of a hierarchy of these responses, and so it's interesting to see what is and isn't used as a response in these sorts of situations.
Yeah, I think the belief being that arrests would draw more attention. That there would be more press coverage, and then sort of follow up questions. If you arrest internationals, then their embassies get involved, particularly the U.S. embassy, but also European embassies. They have consular rights under the international treaties and access, and then they have to follow up on that. Then there would be questions. I mean, imagine if maybe it's not that big a deal in the U.S., but imagine if British citizens were arrested, and there would be questions in Parliament. As you mentioned, there's a lot of attention already in Ireland. Imagine if there was an opportunity for Irish politicians to complain about Irish citizens being mistreated. It seems like there already was. Mm-hmm. So I think that those are the kind of dynamics that the Egyptian government was aware of. Kick and hit people, that's one news cycle. If you arrest them, then it's a couple of news cycles.
Yeah, while you were speaking, I did some further research on the Irish situation, and the Irish Ministry of Foreign Affairs has issued statements noting that they've been in daily contact with the Irish individuals on the Viva Palestina convoy, and had sent diplomatic notices to the Egyptians requesting safe passage into Gaza for them. But that sort of message doesn't gain the sort of public attention public awareness as you say, if there were either injuries, as there seemed to be the case yesterday, or arrests as kind of as another level up in terms of what will gain media and public attention. You mentioned explained quite clearly Egypt is not a free society. And yet it's often seen as being one of the closest U.S. allies in the Middle East outside of Israel. How does a situation like that develop? What is the relationship between the United States and Egypt? How is the relationship between the Egyptian political and political establishment and authorities and the United States?
The relationship is very close, and Egypt is one of the largest recipients of U.S. military and economic aid, has been since the Camp David Accord under the Camp David agreements under the Carter administration, when Egypt and Israel signed a peace treaty, U.S. aid was turned on to Egypt as a reward for the treaty, and Egypt was brought into the U.S. orbit. And throughout the period of that relationship, since the late 70s between the U.S. and Egypt, democracy and freedom has had very little to do with it. There has occasionally been some U.S. pressure on Egypt over democracy and human rights issues. Under the Bush administration, actually, at one point, became significant enough that the U.S. pressure became significant enough that it started to have some impact, actually. And the Egyptian government felt compelled to release some people that they had put in prison and open up a little bit. But that subsequently was reversed. Egypt has sham elections, and there's no real electoral competition for the presidency. Certainly, parliamentary elections are heavily constrained, the press is censored, and there's very little comment about this in Washington or in the United States generally, because the overall cynical view is, well, these people are our friends, and they have a peace treaty with Israel, so we have to support them because it's the Middle East. And part of that dynamic, actually the causality runs the other way, in the sense that the alliance with the United States, the peace treaty with Israel, these are very controversial policies in Egypt. It's not clear that they could be carried out by a democratic government if there were truly democratic elections in Egypt. They might well be won by the Muslim Brotherhood, or certainly by political actors who would not be nearly as closely aligned with U.S. policy. So in a way, the two things are correlated, the close relationship between the U.S. and Egypt, and the lack of democracy in Egypt.
Mm-hmm. A naive observer might see a contradiction between the United States having, you know, such a close relationship with a country that is clearly not democratic. But the way you position it there seems to kind of position very well, I think, that belief that we need to ignore these sort of issues in order to make what the U.S. are seen as gains on the other side in terms of the peace treaty with Israel and so on. Is that sort of trade-off, that sort of answering my own question by saying realpolitik the guiding philosophy of how the U.S. decides, you know, who are seen as allies or worthy of recipients of aid and so on?
Well, it's varied over time. It varies geographically, but the overall story is that democracy and human rights is in practice way, way down on the list of priorities of the U.S. government. It has been since 1945, at least. So it's often useful. There's the rhetoric is used to justify the policy. You know, we're supporting democracy and so on and so forth. But in fact, the U.S. has supported dictatorial regimes in the region as elsewhere, but arguably even more so in this particular region, because in the belief of U.S. officials, the stakes are so high. I mean, so, for example, with respect to Saudi Arabia, I mean, there's just almost no questioning in Washington of U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, even though it's a formal monarchy. So, of course, it's not a democracy. Of course, there isn't the free press in Saudi Arabia. Of course, there aren't free elections. Again, these guys are our friends, they're our allies, so is the view. And so while we should do what we can to promote human rights in Saudi Arabia, it's way, way down on the list of priorities. Of course, in other cases, for example, the 1953 coup against the democratic government in Iran, it would be understating the case to say that democracy and human rights were low on the list of priorities. In fact, the United States intervened against democracy in Iran in order to bring about a government considered to be more friendly to U.S. interests. So that has been that's been the overall story. That's like 90-95% of the story, I would say, in the last 50 years is supporting anti-democratic governments because it was perceived to be in the interests of the U.S., of U.S. corporations, of the U.S. military, sometimes intervening against democracy. And then, 5-10% of the time following through to some degree on the rhetoric about democracy and human rights, occasionally with some positive impact. You know, when the Bush administration made a point of saying after, President Bush, Secretary of National Security Advisor, then Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, at the beginning of the Bush administration, there was very vibrant rhetoric about support for democracy and human rights in the region after September 11th, saying, we've been too cynical supporting these anti-democratic governments, and that's helped produce the situation we face today. We're not going to do that anymore. Some people in the region took that seriously, and the U.S. actually did some things under the Bush administration to indicate that it was serious, and that had some positive impact. That policy was reversed, and those positive impacts have disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Bob, in the last few minutes remaining to us, I want to return to the situation of Gaza directly. We've talked about the blockade. We've talked about the march. I want to kind of focus a little more directly on the people of Gaza, the situation that they face at the moment. You mentioned that since the Israeli invasion a year ago, due to the blockade, it has not been possible to rebuild many of the structures that were damaged or destroyed. Kind of as a guide for listeners, we're talking about a population of around 1.5 million people, an area of about 140 square miles. What is the situation today for people in Gaza? What is life like for the people of Gaza?
It's a big prison. The private economy has largely shut down. Because of the blockade and the economic restrictions, factories have closed. Private employment has dried up. Estimates are that half the population is the labor force is unemployed. People are heavily dependent on international aid to the extent that gets through, or on employment by Hamas as police or security guards or other functionaries of the state, teachers. These salaries are paid. The blockade also causes all kinds of personal hardship. people, although of course there's supposed to be exceptions, there are people can't leave for medical treatment, or when they are allowed to leave for medical treatment, they you know, families can't travel, so there'll be one saw in the last few weeks stories in the press about Palestinian family where a couple of children were killed in the Israeli invasion. One daughter was badly wounded. She was able to get out to receive medical treatment in Germany, but her father cannot get permission to go visit his daughter in Germany. So this is, this is kind of personal hardship in addition to the economic hardship that people are experiencing. Palestinian and international aid organizations have reported very high level of post-traumatic stress disorder among Palestinians in Gaza, particularly Palestinian children, as a result of the Israeli invasion, as a result of the blockade. People feel cut off from the outside world, feel abandoned by the international community. So it's a very grim and unfortunate situation.
Okay. Well, Bob, thank you so much for joining us with that update today. We will, of course, talk again next week, where we'll cover perhaps a wider range of international affairs, as is our wont. Until then, have a good week.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Thank you.